Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is poet Eric Morago, and we're going to be hearing from and talking about his latest published collection, Feasting on Sky. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
Eric, I'm going to say this for the benefit of everybody. There are a few collections that when I've even just read the title, like I feel hooked that I have to read the poem. And yours was one of those collections. There are poems in this collection that I was compelled to read through. So congratulations.
Well, thank you so much. I'm happy to hear that.
Talk to me about, when I talk to poets, I'm always fascinated by that as an occupation. I'm a visual artist, and that's pretty chancy in itself. But if there's anything more chancy than a visual artist, it's a poet. When did you talk to me about your evolution? Like, when did you start writing poetry, and when did you feel confident enough to call yourself a poet?
It's a really funny question. I dabbled in like writing poems, all throughout high school and beyond, and even would go to a random neighborhood open mic.
Did you perform?
Yeah, I read my poems out loud. I wasn't necessarily calling them performing back then. I don't know what I'd call it. I will just call it dabbling. I like that the open mic feel. It was mostly an open mic that I'd go to that was for comedians.
Oh, God. Are you serious?
No, but they loved me because, you're at a comedy open mic, all they do is just judge one another. But if you're going up there doing something different, they love you because you're not competition.
Great insight. That was good.
Yeah.
Because I just had this vision of everybody just throwing crap at you.
No, they actually, I was very well received by the people at that open mic. It wasn't a straight like comedy room. Like, I wasn't going to like the Laugh House or something.
Okay.
It was just a random coffee shop in Long Beach.
Nice.
And it was just something to do on Friday nights.
How old are you at this point?
At this point, I'm probably in my early 20s.
Okay.
And so essentially how things happened was, I'd taken some time off my undergrad. I went to Cal State Long Beach in Southern California and decided it was time for me to go back. And at the time that I was going back, I was just trying to finish up a degree to get me out of there as quickly as possible. And I met with an advisor, and we turned into a English special emphasis degree because I had a bunch of theater classes that counted towards English credits, like theater history and stuff that they can manipulate. So she's like, okay, well, you got to take these like five English classes and you're done. One of them was a creative writing, like poetry classes, like intro to creative writing poetry. I was like, oh, that'll be a cinch. That'll be easy. I'll breeze through it. I've got tons of poems I've written, for open mic. So like, I won't even have to do any work. And, around that same time, I was actually, getting out of a relationship. Well, I wasn't by choice. It wasn't my choice to get out of the relationship. It was her choice when she ended up being with somebody else.
Been there, done that.
Yeah, and it was hard because it was a relationship I really saw going to something further. I was just devastated. And around that same time, the teacher of that poetry class, who was actually in the school's MFA program, brought a friend of his to come perform for us. And this person was a world-famous performance poet by the name of Buddy Wakefield. And seeing him perform just for us, it just hit me. I was in, like, the right place at the right time kind of thing.
Right.
Whereas, like, I think if he came in and performed and I was, like, everything in my life was hunky-dory, I probably wouldn't have been so affected as I was. But I was. I was affected. And, I decided that, hey, I want to be able to give what this, person did for me, I want to be able to give that to other people. And so what I love about poetry is just how communal it is when done well,
right,
between audience and poet. And it's a really... it's a really great shared experience, as all art can be. You know, it's transformative. And what I love about poetry, especially having kind of come up and dabbled in that open mic, atmosphere first, like, I really believed in the connection between the audience and the writer. And so the work, you know, things just evolved from there. I got really first was involved in like the slam poetry scene, mm-hmm. but when I finished my undergrad, which remember the goal was just to get out with a degree, I actually ended up going back in for an MFA. At that same school, because I was like, okay, I've got this whole performance thing down, but I feel like I need to learn a lot more about my craft and, yeah. and want my craft to evolve. So I went through grad school, and so at this point, we'd say it's around, I'm like in my mid to late 20s, so I'd say would call myself a poet right around then, when I was like, this is something I want to do. This is something that I want to contribute to the world. And I was while I was in grad school, I met somebody in one of the classes that I was a grad assistant for, and we were talking, and she's like, when you first introduced yourself and you said, I am a poet, you had such confidence about it. It's like, you didn't say I write poetry, because if you had said you write poetry, I would have assumed you actually just, like, you know, write rhyming gothic poetry while listening to some emo band, like, crying in the shower in the fetal position with candles, you know, burning. And so that's funny when you say, you know, how would you, you know, have, you know, come across saying that you're a poet? So I always go back to that, because it's the difference between calling yourself a poet and saying you write poetry. It's a fetal position away from the label.
And I know those people.
I do too.
I know. I can imagine. Now, the interesting thing is, do you still host the monthly reading series?
I do, actually. I hosted it last night, actually. Yeah. At a bookstore in Southern California. Yeah.
Now, performance is obviously really important for you, and there's such a crossover between acting and performing poetry well for an audience. When you get somebody reading for the first time, afterwards, do you give them any pointers or anything?
You know, not unless they come up and they ask something specific.
Okay.
It's none of my business the way I look at it.
Sure.
If I see somebody who is genuinely great, you know, and that they're new and they're that there's like just raw talent and potential, like I'll go up and I'll tell them and I'll encourage them, maybe share with them some spots they should check out or something. But if somebody needs help,
yeah.
I by all means will offer it to them. I mean, I teach, you know, I teach workshops. I do all that stuff. But I think I've got to be asked. I don't think I'm all that great that I can just go up to somebody and be like, you know what, you should do. I've had teachers like that. You know, like
I know, and like, you know, it's the same. It's the same thing in visual arts too.
Yeah,
yeah. You have the teachers who really over critique.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I'm, you know, long graduated, and I've had professors that I'd work with, they catch me at a reading, they're like, you know what you should have done?
Oh, God.
I was like, really? Okay, thank you. And then I just find an excuse to walk away.
Well, before we go any further, could I impose on you to read a poem from the Feasting on Sky?
Of course. Let me open up my table of contents. And you just go ahead. Why don't you? I know you said you...
How about a good zombie? You're a good zombie, Charlie Brown, just to get the folks in the mood.
All right. That's good. Let me find that. I know it's towards the end.
And we're going to talk about some themes I seem to detect in these poems in this book too. One of which seems to be cryptozoology.
Yeah, actually, yes, definitely. There's definitely a. I have a fascination of cryptozoology, and so I at one point in time, I plan on doing a full like chapbook full of cryptozoology.
I want that.
I know. It's difficult. I mean, you kind of like in this collection, we've got the Loch Ness Monster, we've got Bigfoot. I even throw in Mothman. But
and that's obscure because that's John Keel's book on Mothman. That book, like when I read the book, The Mothman Prophecies by John Keel. That was like one of the weirdest books I've ever read.
I've heard. I'm familiar with it.
Oh, man. Read the book.
I know all about the mythology of Mothman, and I've heard that book is just bizarre.
Well, he was really weird.
All right. So this is You're a Good Zombie, Charlie Brown. It started with Woodstock, some mutated strain of bird flu. His first victim, Pigpen, tasted terrible, but the hunger was just too overpowering to care about good hygiene. Next peanut down was Marcy, cleaning her glasses. She never saw it coming. Upon infection, she went straight for Peppermint Patty. You always hurt the ones you love, sir. When they came for Charlie Brown, he thought, good grief. Wondered if MetLife had him covered as both girls undressed the flesh from his bones. This was not the threesome he wanted. His sister, Sally, heard his screams across the hall and cried hysterically. Cried not for herself, but because she knew who she would go to when she turned. But Linus, not wanting to go out like that, did what he must, took his blue blanket, fashioned a noose around his neck, and hung himself from the ceiling fan. Sally scratched for days at a door to a quiet room. Snoopy showed more courage and jumped atop his doghouse to take aim at Charlie Brown's half-eaten head, though by the time he realized his dogfights with Red Baron were all pretend, it was too late. Blood splattered everywhere. Snoopy became invisible beside his red home. Lucy, seeing there was money to be made in times of a zombie apocalypse, increased her cost for psychiatric help to 15 cents, but soon regretted it when a reanimated Snoopy came for her brain. She was always terrified of his kiss, more so now, tried out running him, but it wasn't long before he was lapping her cheek with his tongue, then chewing it off with his teeth. Her only consolation that, in death, she finally could have what she wanted in life. Schroeder, all to herself, away from his toy piano. She ate his fingers first, like taquitos. Through it all, he continued to play, banged his bloody stumps against the tiny ivory keys until every bit of Beethoven left his body. The sole survivor of the group, Franklin, who having no anxiety or obsessions to distract him, saw this horror show coming and escaped long before his friends noticed he'd gone. He refused to be killed off that way, consumed like cliché, becoming just another monster, same as them.
The amazing thing about that poetry is you followed it all the way through. Like, you started with an idea and explored every single nook and cranny. It was cinematic.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I mean, that was a fun poem to write. There's a reading in Southern California called The Two Idiots Peddling Poetry. And there's weird kind of challenge started developing where people were writing poems about the Peanuts characters in, like, strange and unfamiliar situations. So that was my...
I can see where that's going to go really fast.
I think there was one with a strip club.
Okay.
It's pretty insane. And so I came up with the idea of, like, turning the characters into zombies and just ran with it and really tried to touch on every single character I could think of. And that poem, it was funny, that poem had a completely different ending. I swapped the characters. I wrote this poem before, like, the Black Lives Matter movement and before that was so a part of our culture. And so I started the poem off with Franklin unfortunately passing first because of the cliche of the in horror movies, the trope, you know.
Yep.
Right. And when I was putting the collection together and wanting to include that poem, I just didn't feel right about it anymore. Because at the end, the joke was that Pegpin Liz, because he's so dirty, the zombies can't really differentiate between him and the living. But like I said, I just didn't like anymore having Franklin go first. So I really made it about Franklin being the survivor. And when I was doing research about the Peanuts, it was really interesting. But, like, all the Peanuts characters all have these different psychoses that they're battling with. And it's quite known. I mean, obviously, if Linus the Blanket, Charlie Brown psychosis, like, all the characters have different, you know, psychological issues that they're dealing with, different obsessions or different things, except Franklin. That was the weirdest thing, was that Franklin was in the mythology of the Peanuts, completely well-adjusted.
Right. Exactly right.
So when I read that, I realized this is just too good to pass up. So I'm really happy with how the poem, you know, grew. And I was happy with how it turned out. And thank you for the compliment. I try to let my imagination run wild. It's definitely definitely a tip I learned in grad school from one professor to just go big.
Well, the thing is, a complete animation runs through at least my mind while I was reading it. Like literally, I saw the Peanuts characters, and there was, and then now I want to see that cartoon with your narration.
Well, if you know of any good cartoonist,
well, first of all, you would get sued so fast by the Charles Schulz Foundation. Don't mess with that. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is poet, teacher, Eric Morago. And we're talking about his latest collection, which you want to talk about something that would be great to pick up and just read for the summer. It's Feasting on Sky. And Eric, we were talking about themes. We were talking about cryptozoology. I love the Bigfoot to-do list, which is amazing. But there are other themes in this. And there's an interesting series of poems about your therapist, about therapy, about going to therapy. And it is a weird situation. The weirdest for me, and it's an awkward situation, is when your therapist reads you poetry, his poetry.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. You know, and that's one of the things about your poems is you pick up on situations. Man, did that actually happen?
That did actually happen.
Oh, my God. What a... That was a stupid move on his part.
I mean, you know, he was a great guy.
He may be that, but that's not appropriate.
Yeah. I think he probably blurred some of the lines between patient doctor quite a few times. But I, you know what? I mean, I think that was the kind of therapist I needed.
And okay. As long as it works for you.
I mean, it.
Yeah. That's just one of those situations where as soon as I read the title of the poem, and of course I had to immediately read the entire poem, it sets off a whole different reaction from the, we were talking about the Charlie Brown one, which is just fun. It was very awkward and very personal, as all of these poems are about therapy. It's a very different kind of theme.
Well, yeah, it was definitely when I was putting this collection together, one of the things I really wanted to delve into was mental health. I mean, my own, but also in examining my own, again, it's for the audience. It's hoping that somebody can pick up this book and read it and feel, you know, less alone in their own struggles that they go through. So, you know, I write to basically process, like, the stuff in my head, mm-hmm. like what I'm going through, hoping that in doing that, I heal, but also that my reader, my audience can heal too.
And there's also several poems which are about writing poetry.
Right.
And those are fascinating to me. They were really interesting. Some of them are fun. Some of them are less so, but there's things like Squeeze and Star Stuff. And one of my favorites, this poem isn't very good, but in an alternative universe somewhere, there's a version of it that's much better. I just happened to read that when I was reading a book about the multiverse theories of quantum theory. And I realized, you know, in the multiverse version of the world, of the universe, there are much better versions of that poem.
Exactly.
But I've never read a lot of poetry about that, about literally examining the process of writing as you're writing the poem.
Well, thank you. I mean, I was hesitant to include as much of that as I did in the collection, only because I don't know where I heard this, but like very early when I started writing poetry, like I it was a tip not to write about writing poetry. Like it's too easy. But it's fun to do. It's fun to, you know, be self-aware, I think, and definitely in writing a collection about mental health and processing that, so much of writing is a form of, you know, self-care and mental health.
Right.
Yeah, you know, to be any kind of artist, you got to be a little nuts, because you view the world a little bit differently than a engineer or a doctor.
It seems like the advantage to poetry, like the advantage to other performing arts, is that you get the feedback immediately, whereas when you do a painting, you have no idea what the hell's going on.
Yeah, I mean, you can, unless, you know, like, hopefully, listeners to this radio program will go out and buy Feasting on Sky, so yep. I'm not going to know their reaction. But yes, when I go to do a reading, and I pride myself, like I want my work to perform as well on the page as it is off the page. I pride myself mm-hmm. on being a good reader. You're right. When I'm at a reading, I can gauge exactly from the first line, is the audience there or not? If they're not there, how can I connect with them better?
So that does that in the moment change your reading?
It can. I mean, yeah, it can. Not so much the way that I read, because the way that I read is just the way that I read, but it definitely changes what poems I may choose to read. Like, okay. I may go in thinking I'm going to have one set, but realize, or maybe if I'm viewing, like, a person who read before me, and gauging on how the audience responded to that, there's some poems that would work in a bar setting very easily.
Huh.
And then there's other poems that would work in a quieter room. I'd probably have a different set if I was reading at a college than if I was reading at
So this is very much like musicians and bands.
Yeah.
You're determining your set depending on the venue.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to ask you to read another poem before
sure,
we run out. We're going to run out of time before we talk everything about this.
I apologize. Yeah, anytime you want me to read something, you just let me know. I can ramble at times, so I do.
No, no, I don't mind the rambling at all. But I want to make sure that people hear enough of your poetry. So, could you read another poem? I mean, Why I Wore a Magnetic Earring in the Seventh Grade was really interesting. It's personal, and it's also, I hate to say this, but I'm a huge comics geek. And I really identify with it. I'm a Silver Age guy.
I am too. I'm a big Silver Age collector.
Okay. Except for me, it was contemporary. So that was another theme that came in a lot, was with that sort of pop culture references in this that also made these poems sort of accessible in an interesting and entertaining way.
Well, thank you. That's definitely a goal, is that I do want poems to be, Billy Collins uses the term hospitable, and I feel like using pop culture and using humor, you invite the reader in, and then you get them to stick around with actual, skill and craft.
That's right. That's exactly right. You have to have something to back that up.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll read Why I Wore a Magnetic Earring, and how about I read that my therapist shares his poetry with me, since you mentioned that.
Okay, do that one first.
Okay, yeah, that's probably good. You can have a palate cleanser with me wearing a magnetic earring. I got to look in the table of contents real quick.
Now I sort of want to read your therapist poetry too. That's the scary thing.
Oh, terrible. It was so, I hope he doesn't listen to this. It was not the best.
That's so awkward. That's just
start with a W. Oh yeah, there it is. Page 86. Yeah, it was not great.
Oh my God.
It was...
I can just envision the body language from you as this was going on.
I was like one of those moments where you're like, is this really happening right now?
Right, is this a test?
Yeah, so, I think the poem pretty much explains things. So I'll just read the poem. When my therapist shares his poetry with me... In the evenings, I teach a poetry workshop. One student is a chiropractor, but I've never considered requesting she realign my spine in between critiques. Imagine it, me face down on the floor, her hands finding their way along vertebrae as I work out the kinks riddling her words, a cacophony of cracks and pops stifling the clarity of my edits. So when my therapist shares his poetry with me during one of our sessions, I wonder if he's crossing a line. Or perhaps it's not so uncommon for him to have his opinion solicited in someone else's office, when he's being charged by the hour, when he's vulnerable and seeking answers only their expertise can give. As he reads his poem out loud, as it lunges from his mouth, a crazed bungee jumper too excited to take caution before the leap, to be certain there's enough space between the end of the rope and the earth, I become more and more uncomfortable, as though it is my own body at risk here. But when he finishes, it is his silence that dangles its limbs in front of us, and for once, he is the bridge uncertainty hurtles from, while I am the ground it falls towards. There is power in such inevitability. He asks for my thoughts, wants to know about his trees and the dirt and the red sky, how his red sky lives in balance with it all, how everything lives in balance. I don't like nature poetry, but understand his intent behind describing the soil as brick-like, yet soft as powdered sugar, and showing that which is suspended above is the same below. Waiting my response, his eager inkblot eyes beg for meaning, some small validation his words aren't crazy, that they make sense to someone trained, like myself. I see the reflection in the symmetry, but choose not comment on it. Instead, I simply tell him, I think your poem is working.
Wow. That's a good poem.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. And now for something completely different.
Go for it. We only have minutes left, so go for it.
Oh, wow. Wow, really? We went through all that time? Man.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Cool. We'll have you back. Don't worry about it.
Why I wore a magnetic earring in the seventh grade. Because they killed off Superman, broke Batman's back, and drove Hal Jordan mad. 90s comic books were getting more extreme, so I thought I should do the same, and shoplifted, sort of, a cubic zirconia magnetic earring, because I was too embarrassed to hand my money over for it to the girl working behind the counter. When her back was turned, I left the cash beside the register and ran. I marveled at how the fake diamond reflected light like a prism when the sun hit the stone just right. I almost looked cool, its faux gemstone gleam, my bat signal I was no longer a boy but a teenager ready for making dumb decisions. Magnets pinching skin over time hurt, and eventually I was concerned with just how numb my ear had grown, a poor pinned mouse in a trap. When I finally set it free, a small crater remained. It took over a day for the dimple to vanish, but sometimes I feel its impression still there. A year later, and Superman returned from the grave, farm boy wholesome as ever, except for his new haircut, a mullet. I stopped reading comic books for a while after that.
That's a great poem, too.
Thank you.
And I know that issue of Superman.
Yeah,
when he died, and then all of a sudden he's back.
Yeah, with a mullet. Oh, God. And
We're completely out of time. We're going to have you back, Eric.
Wow,
there's a lot of things I want to talk to you about, too. My guest tonight has been poet Eric Morago, and you've been hearing him read just two poems from a great collection called Feasting on Sky. That's M-O-R-A-G-O. Do yourself a favor and pick this collection up. Eric, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.